Is this good?
Yeah.
All right. CinemaJaw is sponsored by Overcast, an independent podcast app that embraces the open world of podcasting instead of locking it down. No exclusives, no premium content, no paywalls. Just a great podcast app for everyone. Get it for free in the App Store.
CinemaJaw is also brought to you by Jiffy On Demand. Broken things can still pop up around the house. Toilets and sinks can get backed up. Washing machines break. If you need help, Jiffy is still available. Their pros have been advised to practice safe protocols like washing hands before and after jobs, sanitizing equipment before and after, reassigning jobs if they are at heightened risk, communicating only over the app as opposed to in person as much as possible. And guys, outdoor jobs can still be done without any interaction with another person. Jiffy prides itself on being paperless, so if you want your lawn done, your roof fixed, your exterior windows washed, or your walkway power washed, all you need to do is put it in the app and communicate with your pro. Oh, and get this, Jiffy knows they're not going to save the world, but if they can make it so jawheads have an extra $50 in their pocket during this time, then that's what they're going to do. The offer code CINEMAJAW is now worth $50 off your Jiffy job. So check them out, Jiffy On Demand, and we thank them for their support. Listening to CinemaJaw, the greatest movies podcast ever, recorded on location at our respective homes in Chicago. My name is Matt Kay, and with me is
Rye the Movie Guy. And this week on CinemaJaw, Matt, we talk about our first times.
Whoa,
not
really?
Our first time podcasting, and not what you're thinking there, Matt Kay. We're talking first time acting. We are doing our top five acting debuts. Wow.
Yeah. Well, hopefully your first acting debut wasn't your first time in what I was thinking, if you catch my drift.
No, we are doing our top five acting debuts, and there have been some big splashes when it comes to making acting debuts when I was doing my research.
There have been. One of the things I was thinking about, and I'll go into this in greater detail when we get to the list, but every great actor has had a debut, and most of them have been great, right?
No, not most of them have been great.
No.
As far as their debuts go?
Okay, maybe not most, but many of them have.
No, I mean, a lot of times you think of it like they started off in a very small role. I mean, we're celebrating Michael Shannon this week, or this month, I should say.
Right,
and
right.
And we did a fact last week on the show that Michael Shannon's first role was in Groundhog Day, and it was just an extremely bit part. That wasn't like some great acting debut that he had. That was just a bit part, you see?
Ryan, I stand corrected. You're right. You know, I think about a Christian Bale, whose acting debut famously was in the movie Newsies. Not a great role.
I never saw it, so I can't comment.
It actually was a pretty great role, but...
But you get what my drift. Most probably start off in smaller roles. It's not something so memorable. The ones we're tackling today are memorable film debuts.
Got it.
We're doing this because we are reviewing a small indie film that has one of these acting debuts that we will be discussing probably in years to come. I think anyways.
Yeah, no, perhaps more than one. We will be covering Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
Also, you know, we've been recording here at home and we've been playing Stump the Kabinski, but we asked your wife to come in and play some movie trivia. So for the first time ever, Matt Kay will play his wife, Heather, in Spouse movie trivia. Heather, thank you for doing this.
Hey, guys. I will see you later in the show and I'm going to take Matt down.
That is going to be a blast, Matt. You've got to be nervous to play your wife in trivia.
Yeah, I'm nervous for a lot of reasons. I'll explain when we get to trivia.
Like I mentioned, we're celebrating Michael Shannon month, all month of April. So let's start right there. What do we got, Michael Shannon-wise?
All right, here's a fact for you, Ryan. Michael Shannon was asked in an interview if he feels like he has an intense or conflicted-looking face, as seemingly others do. And his answer was, well, there seems to be something inherently intense about my face. I guess my bone structure. Even if I'm just sitting in a totally neutral state, not thinking about anything in particular, that intensity is projected on my face. I've wondered over the years why that is. A friend of mine once said, it looks like I have psychic baggage, which I guess is true to a certain extent, although I have a hard time imagining anybody who doesn't. I guess it just comes through maybe more clearly on my face than other people's faces.
I love that response, and I love that observation. He does always look intense. He's a very intimidating looking person in general.
He is. He is, and he uses that to great effect in many of his roles, but I believe there's a term for this. It's just called resting bee face.
Is that what it's referred to as?
Yeah. Have you ever had you're hanging out with a friend or girlfriend or something, and you just look over and you're like, hey, what's wrong? And they'll look back at you and say, nothing. Why? Oh, I don't know. You just really looked upset there. That's resting bee face.
Interesting. Well, it's funny because I'm going to tell a story here where I actually met Michael Shannon two times, and I've told one on the job before. The second time, and I'm going to go back to this one, was at a meet and greet. You've been at these things. They're sort of awkward.
They're very awkward. Yeah.
And this is where they sometimes, in this particular instance, it was a cocktail meet and greet. So it was right before the Chicago International Film Festival.
Oh boy. Were you lit?
We'll get there. But okay. It was in that scenario. But that's the second time I met him. The very first time, and this is one that I told on Cinema Jaw before, was I was just a youngin', didn't know the city that well, didn't know Steppenwolf Theater that well and the history behind it all. But I had picked a play to go see there. And me and my girlfriend at the time went to Steppenwolf and just randomly saw The Pillow Man, which was the play, playing. And Michael Shannon was starring as The Pillow Man. And at this time, he's not Michael Shannon, the actor. He hadn't made any type of like breakout role film-wise anyways. He was on stage, and that face that we just described is just intimidating. And the film is dark and intense, and it's in a way scary. It really has an effect on the audience. After sitting through the play, I was just freaked out, and the play ends and we sort of sat around finishing our drinks. And then, you know how it is. You go to the bathroom, girlfriend goes to the bathroom. It's taking a long time. The place is almost cleared out. And while I'm waiting, I sort of like walk outside of Steppenwolf right onto Halstead there. And then I walk back in. And as I'm walking back in, here comes the Pillow Man, Michael Shannon, right at me. And I'm terrified by this man. I just saw him on stage. I wanted to play it cool and say something like, hey, really good job. And I mean, again, I don't know him as an actor at this point, but I couldn't even muster that up. I just sort of got the door for him, just mustered like, here you go.
A quick nod.
Yeah, like a nod. And he like looked me right in the eyes like, thank you. And he just walked right out into the street. So now flash forward to a couple of years ago while he was about to go out for The Shape of Water at the Chicago International Film Fest. There's one of these meet and greets with the press. And again, it's awkward a lot of times because they're bringing a celebrity into a room of journalists and film critics that are told necessarily not to take like pictures with them, but, you know, talk to him about his film career and such. So I was like, okay, you know, this will be all right. When it gets to be my chance, and it eventually did, I said, I got a story in my back pocket and I'll tell him about how I got the door for him and saw him as the Pillow Man. So I go up to him and I say, hey, Michael, you know, Ryan, do a podcast, Cinema Jaw. And I'll never forget the first time I saw you. And I tell him, I saw you at the Pillow Man and you scared the hell out of me, you know? And I thought that would get like a joke from him. And he was just so happy that I had saw him in the Pillow Man. And he gave me that intense look. And he's like, you were there? You saw me as the Pillow Man? That's awesome. And he shook my hand. And it was just a really nice quick moment with Michael Shannon because I was still scared as hell of the guy.
Yeah, no doubt. I would be scared as hell. I would be totally terrified. He's a cool guy, man. That's a great story.
So we got more interesting facts and clips that we'll be playing all month long for Michael Shannon. Also, Matt, one thing I did want to mention is besides trivia, we'll also have some Hollywood headlines after the break. So we got a jam-packed jaw.
As always, Ryan.
Let's get it started with a good review.
Heck of a review. Let's go.
All right. In these sunny and happy times we find ourselves in, we decided here on Cinema Jaw, it's a great time to review a serious and sincere story about a young girl who finds herself with an unwanted pregnancy. Actually, never, rarely, sometimes, always has been on our radar since it made a splash at Sundance. Now, due to the quarantine time that we live in, the film is available to stream on VOD. So Matt and I, two people who care about each other, checked out a film about two cousins who do care about each other as well.
I didn't see you at school today.
I went to the doctor.
What's wrong?
Girl problems.
Don't you ever just wish you were a dude?
All the time.
This is the most magical sound you will ever hear.
Down beneath the ashes and stone.
I'm just not ready to be a mom.
Where else could you go?
Nowhere in Pennsylvania.
I think you should try another place.
The film opens with a young girl singing in a talent show at school. A young boy yells out a disgusting term for cheap and ignorant laughs. The vulnerable girl singing is Autumn, played by Sydney Flanagan. The song she is singing is a peek into her life and situation. She suspects, and after taking a test, knows for sure she is pregnant. The pregnancy is unwanted. In fact, we never find out who the father is. That isn't what the point of this film is. Autumn, who we can tell is a quiet girl to begin with, has never felt more alone. She is 17, and in Pennsylvania, where she lives, you have to get a parent to agree and sign off on having an abortion. Not wanting to go talk to her mother, she turns to her cousin, who is the same age. With her caring help, they venture to New York to have the procedure done there. This is in no way an easy topic to discuss, and that is what I found to be the point of the film. Countless young girls find themselves in situations in which they are ashamed when they shouldn't be, and so afraid to talk to anyone when they shouldn't be afraid. As for Sydney Flanagan's performance, amazing. Look, we're doing a top five based on her debut, but Matt, there is a lot to take in here. Did this movie hit you as hard as it hit me?
Yes and no. I found both the leads, Sydney and her cousin, played by Talia Ryder, as well as the main supporting actor, Theodore Perelin, to all be fantastic. The film is an unflinching and honest look at a very uncomfortable subject, teenage abortion. The journey from suburban Pennsylvania to New York City was successfully shown to be fraught, frightening, and exhausting for these two young ladies. When Autumn finally makes it to her first appointment, the emotional journey reaches a gut-wrenching peak in a scene that not only gives the film its unusual name, but also is able to show a batch of raw emotion that would stand up to the likes of the argument scene in Marriage Story. It's powerful stuff, Ryan. I really applaud the fact that while the film is obviously on the side of its protagonist, it doesn't preach or take a firm side as to what is right or wrong in her situation. Again, it's firmly in her corner through this journey, but the audience is never clobbered over the head with a point of view. Instead, the situation simply plays out organically, and we're left to make our own judgments. Where I take issue is the absolute lack of any positive male in this film. Even a smile from a kind bus driver would have been welcome in what comes across as somewhat misandrist. And I say that very, very sparingly, if that makes sense. I'm very cautious with that term. I'm a feminist, and I think our listeners know that. I'm always on the lookout for powerful female roles. I think this is a great story that has a lot to say. Even when men are dupes and victims in a story, like in Blow the Man Down a couple weeks ago, I appreciate the reversal of the Bechdel test as a storytelling device. However, in Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, men are monsters who are casually abusive at best, expose themselves to strangers, and always sexually deviant. And that rubbed me wrong. This was an unforgivably bleak and misanthropic point of view that diminished the movie for me and took me out of the reality it tried to create. So, Raya, I put the question to you. What do you think? Was it just me, or were there no good guys here?
Well, let me tackle that.
This is a tough one.
Yeah, let me tackle that question second, because firstly, I made note here that you just talked about this particular scene in which the title of the film comes up. And I have mentioned here on Cinema Job numerous times that I am not a fan of when the title of a film comes up in a movie most of the time. Every once in a while, it's done right.
I agree.
However, it happens to come up here in the most stirring scene of the film. This is a stagnant single shot scene with only Sydney Flanagan on screen. And it's as moving of a moment in a film that I've seen in a long time. You're right. It's right up there with the argument scene in Marriage Story. I was sitting there in my little screening room with tears coming down my cheek watching that particular scene. It was unbelievable. It's not uncommon to get emotion conveyed like this in a scene, by a screen veteran, say by like Natalie Portman or Cate Blanchett, but for it to come from a debut performance here, my hat is off to Sydney Flanagan, because it's subtle acting. It's not some showy screaming moment. Those are usually the most difficult to pull off. And I can't tell you how powerful that scene was. Incredible. Well,
I completely agree. I think what makes that scene incredibly powerful is the fact that it's such a range in just a short amount of time. Like, she's basically answering a questionnaire before her procedure. And it's very personal questions, obviously. At first, she's just trying to be brave and tackles the questions. They're all pretty routine, like medical questions about allergies and such. And then as they start to get more and more personal, you see her slowly start to come apart, where you could tell she's reliving, the character is reliving something. And it was just, blew me away, man. Such an amazing performance.
So why I wanted to start there to tackle your other question of if there are any good guys, or did this movie just play a bad hand to all the entire male race? If you look at that scene, I think the message of the movie is how alone a lot of young people find themselves, you know, in this situation. We're talking about young women and, you know, having this difficult decision to make, but young people across the board, when they get into situations where they don't feel they can go to an older person, an adult, a guardian, because they're embarrassed. And usually that embarrassment comes from society's rules that we've put out there, making them feel embarrassed. But really, probably what's transpired here is they should have nothing to be embarrassed about. But unfortunately, they find themselves in this situation. And when you're young and you don't have that outlet to talk to an adult, you feel extremely alone. And so I think that's more the message. I think we're seeing through sort of her eyes and her being alone and what's happened to her. I don't think the movie at all was trying to make this loud statement about guys being bad. And in fact, the guy that they meet in New York, I don't think is 100% bad. I think he's, because he's not aware of their situation, he's acting very much, I think it's more like an honest portrayal of a young guy in New York who sees two attractive young girls. That's sort of how a young guy would probably act. I can't say that was in any way not truthful. I thought that was quite truthful.
I agree and disagree. Again, I agree that that's definitely not the message that was trying to be conveyed in the film. It's not the main point of the movie, but it's a little insidious that it hides in there. And it jumped out at me, man. And honestly, I think that it's inaccurate in that way. Obviously, there are bad people and they are of both genders and any other gender identity. Like, bad people can be anybody. They're not just men. They're not just women. They're all of us, and any of us could be a bad person. So I disagree with you that the film didn't take a pot shot or maybe accidentally get a little too dark in that regard. The guy that they meet in particular, this is kind of like the case where you could take a scene where something happens in a film and remix it with maybe different camera angles, different lighting, different music, and take a very innocent scene and make it seem sinister. While this kid, I agree, was probably acting the way that an honest early 20-something male would act if he sees a couple of attractive girls on the bus. And he didn't do anything disrespectful or rude. He just said, hey, would you like to hang out? But they showed him as so creepy. He was almost like a boogeyman in certain scenes. I don't know, man. Something about it threw me off. And I think I would have loved the movie a lot more had it not been for those feelings.
It's odd because I didn't feel that way at all. I mean, I think that the scene in particular where they're on the bus, where he does invite them, you know, to see some live music and tries to get their phone number, is a little creepy. But isn't it always a little creepy when somebody is asking for someone's number and they're trying to get a girl to go out with them?
No.
It is to some degree. When you just meet, I mean, it's young.
It's awkward. It doesn't have to be creepy. It's definitely awkward.
I guess, okay, go with awkward, but that's what I would say the scene was to me. I thought it was the normal awkwardness that a young guy was trying to get a girl's phone number. And he wasn't some mega player type of guy. I think he was awkward enough of a dude where he was trying to act cool in front of these girls, but he wasn't cool. I think that's the way I read it, is he's sort of a dork also. He's just a little bit older than them and knows you know, his way around New York a little bit, because that's where he's from. And he has that one advantage of trying, because of that, of being cool in their eyes. And he's playing that for, to try to meet these young girls. I didn't find it creepy, more awkward.
I'm going to have to just agree to disagree with you on this one. I think that especially the resolution of his character arc, and again, I really don't want to spoil anything, but it almost introduces a theme of near, like, even to say the word would spoil something. So I'll just say that he comes across as a guy who pays his way through a relationship. I didn't like that. I didn't like how that wrapped up. And it just seems also like taking us back to the very beginning. I mean, listen, I liked this movie. It's just this one little nitpick I have that rubbed me wrong. But taking it all the way back to the beginning, which is the talent show, somebody yells out something very derogatory to this person on stage. I'm sorry, but that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, maybe when we were in high school, Ryan, that might have happened. But even then, I think like a teacher would have run over there and like hauled that person out if you make that public of a use of the word that he used while somebody's on stage at a talent show. Like, people would have been outraged today. If that happened today, no, that would have been shut down.
I will give you that the reaction from everybody, I mean, even people laughing because, you know, the group of guys that are around them all like laugh and they sort of show like it's a people snickering. That wouldn't have happened.
No.
It would have been outrage, I agree, or shock if I heard somebody yell that out. I would have been over there punching the guy.
Yeah, that would have been like 30 years ago, like maybe. Yeah. But anyway, minor nitpicks for what is otherwise, I think, just an amazing, depressing movie.
It is. And another thing that I think you touched on when you were going over the film was the realistic interpretation of these two girls going to New York City.
Yeah.
Because we don't realize or see it depicted anyways in movies how challenging that would be if you were two, you know, 17-year-old girls from Pennsylvania, you know, a suburb in Pennsylvania that think they're going to New York for a day and things get pushed back and they have to be there for a little bit longer than they expected. How difficult that would be for people who don't have money, know anybody, how big the city is, how you take the metro. I liked how all that had a feel that it was a big, scary place for two young girls to go over by themselves, and anybody would be at that age, you know?
I liked that quite a bit. That was something I could relate to personally. When I was a teenager, my parents moved to Michigan and I stayed on the East Coast to like finish high school, and I had a girlfriend in a band, didn't want to leave, right? So I would take the Greyhound bus 24 hours from suburban Connecticut through New York City and then across the United States to Michigan. And it was a 24-hour Greyhound trip. And we stopped in Toledo. We stopped in some interesting places. It was a journey that I could relate to, having lived something quite similar. So,
And then one other scene and sort of a moment that takes place is a moment between these two cousins. And I think this is another theme in the movie, the theme of friendship and the power of friendship, and also supporting your friends, in this case, their cousins, but that support system that everybody needs, right? We think we're all tough and don't need it, but you really do need somebody by your side. And this great moment that is just them with their pinkies crossed, another emotional, moving moment that I just loved.
Was this the moment where the guy, the male lead?
He's like also that. Involved.
I didn't like that moment. Sorry, man.
I liked it a lot.
At that point, I was maybe too distracted with what I was thinking about the movie's portrayal of men, and it bothered me.
Wow. But overall, I'm a big fan of this one. How many Jaws here, Matt Kay?
I struggled with this because I think I took marks off for what I think was unrealistic in what otherwise could have been one of the most honest movies. So I'm only giving it 2.5 Jaws.
Oh, my.
I would have given it 3 otherwise.
I'm at 3.5 Jaws.
Wow.
3.5 Jaws. I was a big fan. Very, very moved by this one. How about a movie poster quote?
Never, rarely, sometimes, always is an honest and unflinching and painful glimpse into a teenage reality.
I went with chalk this one up as one of the best films you'll only want to see once.
It is that. It's a requiem for a dream. This is a once and done kind of movie.
Yeah, it's not one you're going to be like, oh, I want to own that and have it on DVD. It's sad. No. It's depressing.
Can we do a comedy next week, for God's sake? There's that Daniel Radcliffe where he's got guns taped to his hands. That looks great.
3.5 Jaws from Ryan the Movie Guy. 2.5 Jaws for Matt K. If you've seen Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, and you agree, disagree, just want to comment, write us feedback at cinemajaw.com, or you can always shoot us a tweet at cinemajaw. We'll retweet it and get the discussion going.
Yeah, and we say that every week, but honestly, I would love to hear some jawheads this time. And
I agree.
Let me know what you think on this, because I'm still on the fence, and maybe I'll give it that extra half a jaw and get it up to 3. So I did like this, but.
Yeah, I did want to mention one more time, it's out on video on demand, so you can rent it any streaming service you so choose to use. You can find it there.
Yeah, fair warning, jawheads. This was a $20 rental, which, you know, real quick, Rye, how'd you feel about that price tag?
Well, I had mentioned to you, you know, not during a recording, but I we get a lot of things free.
We do.
In the position like
if you were an average Joe.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough because right now, the way I saw it, I can only go by the way I could see it. And I just felt, as I was telling you, was, look, this movie was supposed to have when I say a big box office, I'm talking about an indie film, big box office.
Right. Like an art house.
Right, art house type movie. And it was rolling out, and then we got quarantined and they didn't know what to do. And so they decided to throw it out on video on demand and try to hype it up online. And I actually felt good about supporting it, because normally, to be absolutely honest, I probably would have got a press screening for this and saw it for free.
Right, same.
And in this case, I spent $20. Right, I spent $20 and I felt good about spending that 20 bucks.
All right. Well, jawheads, be warned. This is a $20 rental, but it is for a film that ostensibly would be in theaters currently. So there you are.
Yep. You got to agree that Sidney Flanagan was quite spectacular, right?
I think both the leads were, but in particular, yes, that scene just elevated her performance to a whole different level.
So watching that and then looking at IMDb and seeing that she only has one credit, you can pull up her name right now, and it's pretty cool to see. She has literally one credit, and it's just this. And it's quite the performance. So that got us thinking. Best acting debuts, lot to go from here. Matt, any criteria that you set yourself up here for?
Yeah, there was a little bit of criteria. I wanted to pick actors and actresses that weren't just one-hit wonders, with very little exception. All of these people have gone on to have amazing careers.
Funny, because we didn't discuss any type of criteria, but I actually went with the same. I wrote down a whole list, what I do, and then I tried to narrow it down. And looking at the list, I thought, well, it's not fair to pick, you know, one-hit wonders. And even people who are extremely talented, one you're not going to hear me mention is Jennifer Hudson, who made her screen debut in Dreamgirls, won the Academy Award. She's mega talented in other ways, but it didn't, you know, translate to she's going to be a great actress. She's a great singer. The role was right for her. It worked. But I really wanted to go, same thing, Matt, where it was a great debut and it was something that sort of launched a very promising career. We've already seen that, or we're in the midst of seeing a promising career come out of it.
I'll get us started this week, Ryan. At number 5, talk about an amazing career that continues to this day after decades on the screen. Always a treat to see this woman. She's been in musicals. She's been in dramas. She can sing and dance. Julie Andrews, her screen debut as Mary Poppins. Talk about hitting it out of the park, you know? This movie, to this day, stands the test of time. It's got to be over 50 years old. Can we throw that in the jaw box? I don't have a year on this one, but it's old.
We will throw that one into the jaw box.
I love Julie Andrews. Sound of Music is one of my favorite movies. And Saving Mr. Banks from not too long ago, she pops up and she proves that she can still act. She's a wonderful talent, a national treasure, an international treasure, and I love her.
There's very few people out there that don't know the name Julie Andrews.
True. And Mary Poppins, what a debut, right?
Unbelievable. They just made the remake Mary Poppins. Didn't have the same magic.
Well, is it a remake or is it kind of a sequel?
It's a sequel. But, you know, I mean, they were going for like a spiritual sequel / remake. You know,
a reboot. I hear actually everyone that has seen it that I know said it was very good. I still haven't caught up with it myself. Mm.
My number five, we go back to 1998. He was just a teen at the time. In fact, throw it in the Jawbox. I want to know how old this actor was when he made the movie. Going with a Wes Anderson film here.
Okay. I know who and you're going
with. I think everybody knows this one because he launched the career of Jason Schwartzman in 1998.
He sure did.
He played Max Fisher in Rushmore. And I remember seeing Rushmore and it was my standout Wes Anderson film. I wasn't like a huge Wes Anderson film as a fan as much as I was a fan of Rushmore. I just loved Rushmore. I just enjoyed Jason Schwartzman's performance. I loved how he was in all the clubs. Absolutely perfect for the type of humor that Wes Anderson was trying to go for. And that could be tricky when Wes Anderson wasn't quite, you know, the established forces. Now you tell somebody it's got Wes Anderson type humor, that means something. But back in 1998, when all he had was Bottle Rocket under his belt, didn't mean so much. People like Bill Murray got it, right? And he's in Rushmore. But to cast somebody as young as Jason Schwartzman to play the lead, Max Fisher, was awesome. And I think it's probably still his best role to date, even though he's been excellent in all the Wes Anderson films that he's appeared in. There's been several. But other highlights include Scott Pilgrim, awesome. Marie Antoinette, Shop Girl. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
And a small movie recommendation here for the Jawheads called The Overnight, which is a raunchy R-rated comedy with Jason Schwartzman that I can't recommend enough. Big fan of the guy.
Huge fan myself, man. At number four, this is where I have a comedian.
Okay.
He went on to have just a titanic career, man, marked by humongous ups and a humongous down as well, Ryan. It sort of came down like a starship falling from the sky. Eddie Murphy debuted with Nick Nolte in 48 Hours. Yes, he was on Saturday Night Live at the time, and people kind of knew he was a rising star, certainly in the comedy scene, and his album was out, and he was doing well. He was on the rise, but he proved that he was the triple threat and really did acting very well in 48 Hours, and he stole the show. He was the star of that film.
I agree. I think that's one of those where he was showing that he could do it all, but of course, you never know 100% if it could translate to being a movie star as well. And that's one of those, he debuts with that and it's like, yep, he's a movie star also.
Yep, for real. I mean, of course he would go on to do the Beverly Hills Cop series, all the way up to today after a disastrous turn in his career where he finally got Dolomite Is My Name. I think he's back on track, Ryan.
He is. My number four, sort of an odd pick, younger actress, but I think why it landed on my list ultimately was when I had heard who she was, who she was related to, I thought, oh, I'm never going to buy this movie at all. What am I going to see here? Totally blew me away. 2011, when I heard that Elizabeth Olsen was the younger sister of the Olsen twins. You got to remember, the Olsen twins are the only thing we knew. And to hear that they got a younger sister that was in a serious movie called Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, and it's about a cult. And can I buy this? And I go and see it, and yeah, I could buy it. She's acting-wise much more talented than her sisters. Completely works. And of course, in the movie, she plays Martha, who escapes from a cult but can never really get past it mentally. Great movie if you haven't seen Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. She goes on to do other highlights. She did a movie called Liberal Arts. You ever hear of the Scarlet Witch in all the Marvel films?
No, no? Never heard of it.
Highly recommend Wind River with Jeremy Renner. Love that one. And also the horror film Silent House. And she's one that she's still very young, so she doesn't have that many credits yet, but clearly talented and somebody we're going to see for a long time.
Godzilla as well. She was
She was in Godzilla as well.
Yeah.
The latest.
Famously, her nose was very distracting to our old producer, Elias Rodriguez.
Cinema Jaw flashback to episode 192.
Yeah, though I do want to bring up one tiny spoiler alert. It is like, to me, it is throughout the movie, and if you're listening to this, skip ahead 1 minute, because I don't want you to watch the movie thinking what Elias in the Jawbox said here. And the spoiler alert is the scariest monster in the movie is Elizabeth Olsen's nose job. I could not stop staring at, if you haven't seen her, Her broad face and tiny little... Here's the thing. You're watching this thing. If you're going to see this in 3D, it's so disturbing how that little nub nose is coming at you. I'm not even kidding.
Okay, that swings it back to me at number three. I said at the top of this list that all of these actors have had a subsequent career to point to. This one has not. This is my exception. But holy crap, I can't wait for her career. Elsie Fisher and her turn as Kyla in Eighth Grade.
Nice.
My favorite movie of the year. If not, it was number two or three.
I'll give you this one. Yeah, this is a good one.
It was a fantastic role, and we talked about it when we were discussing Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, this honesty. This movie is not that dark, not even close. It's a little bit more played for comedic effect, but it is just as honest with its subject matter, and it is a very, well, just honest, I hate to reuse the word, but that's what it is, portrayal of what it's like to be in eighth grade and that social strata climbing and trying to be cool, go to parties, make friends with older kids so you can get into the clique of high school and, you know, all that awkwardness of being about to become a teenager in a real way. She hit it out of the park, dude.
She did. I'm excited to see what she does. I agree. I went back and I watched that film, you know, after that particular year was done, and it was just, saw the screener and I thought, you know, give this one another spin. And it was even more enjoyable a second time. And I was really able to appreciate her performance in it. She's awesome.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was also a directorial debut for Bo Burnham. There you go, Jawheads. That's a twofer.
My number three could be your number one. I'm just going to say it right now, Matt. I could be stealing your number one. I hate to do that to you, buddy.
I doubt it.
My number three, when you look back at this 1996 debut, most Jawheads here will say, yes, of course, that's who they were thinking. It's their number one. He starred in just absolutely fabulous. I the movie itself, solid, now that I've watched it in recent times, but the performance is fabulous. I'm speaking of Edward Norton in Primal Fear.
Yeah, yeah. Better Richard Gere movie than Pretty Woman? Debatable, but it is one of the best Edward Norton performances, although he has had many since then.
Yes. Yes. I was shocked when I probably watched this within 3 year period here. And when I did rewatch it, I don't want to say I was let down, but I guess the movie as a whole took a backseat to Ed Norton's performance in the film. Like, oh yeah, it's a pretty good movie, but Ed Norton's really good in it. You know, of course he would go on to have, I mean, just an absolute mega career. I'm looking at just some of, you know, the highlights, be it Fight Club, American History X, he's in Birdman, The Hulk, 25th Hour, a Spike Lee underrated film, and most recently in Motherless Brooklyn that came out last year, in which he also directed, out on DVD now, and you can rent that one also. Highly recommend it if you haven't seen it. So Ed Norton, Primal Fear, my number three.
Good pick, Ryan. Into our number twos, this is where I throw another international treasure. We got to see him first as a villain, Ryan, and he kind of stuck with that through most of his career, although he did take a heroic turn here and there. Alan Rickman, Hans
Die
Gruber.
Hard.
Yeah. Just, you know, I don't think there has been a better villain in what should have been just a throwaway action, cheesy 80s piece of garbage. For some reason, Die Hard is equal to more than the sum of its parts, the least of which is not Alan Rickman. He is tremendous in Die Hard. He really makes the movie. I mean, Bruce Willis is also really good, but without Alan Rickman, you do not have a Die Hard.
Wholeheartedly agree. I think his character is just as memorable as Bruce Willis's Yippee-ki-yay. I mean, it's peanut butter and jelly. You need those two together.
You do. And they tried to recapture that magic so many times, and I don't think any of the Die Hard sequels, I'm going out on this limb, Ryan, none of them mean anything to me. But the first Die Hard movie means everything to me, due in large part, like you said, the peanut butter to McClane's jelly is Alan Rickman. And, you know, he would go on to play the Sheriff of Nottingham. He would be Severus Snape in the Harry Potter films. It was great in Galaxy Quest. I love the guy.
I agree. And Die Hard, it's just a wonderful film to think back. I know I got a special memory of renting that one with my dad, where it was just a guy's night.
Sure.
I don't know where my mom and my brother were, but it was just me and my dad. and we picked Die Hard, you know, and this is the first time I'm watching it. And I just remember halfway through turning to my dad and saying, this is a really good movie.
Yes, it is.
And he's like, you're damn right it is.
Yeah, it really is, man. It's a good one.
A lot of fun with that one. My number two pick for me is an actress who I think is maybe, if not the most talented, in the top three most talented actors working today. And her breakout's in a film that I had just talked about a few episodes back. So I didn't want to, and I toyed with it, but I think it bears repeating. I'm going with Saoirse Ronan, who had her debut in the movie Atonement. It earned her first Oscar nomination. And this is where she plays the younger sister that is the cause of so much heartache in the film. I can still remember coming out of the theater after seeing the film and saying, boy, was that little girl good in the movie. You know, when they make their debuts, you don't know who these actors are at the time. You know, she's not a name. It was a Keira Knightley movie. It had James McAvoy in it and some young girl. That's what I remember. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming out of the movie and saying, boy, was that young girl really good in the film. And of course, it was Saoirse Ronan, Oscar nominated. And then she goes on to do Lady Bird, Little Women, Brooklyn. Little sneaker here that I thought maybe people haven't seen is Mary, Queen of Scots, which came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah. So one, if you haven't seen, I do recommend checking that one out as well. So Saoirse Ronan, I think at this point she can do no wrong. She's in that category now where if she makes a movie, Rye the movie guy is going to see it.
Nice pick, Ryan. I respect it. I'm wondering, I think I have your number one sussed out.
You don't. It's an odd pick for me.
Well, can I ask one question?
Okay.
Does any character in the movie wear an eye patch?
No.
Okay. All right, maybe I don't then. All right, that swings it to me. Here we are at our number ones acting debuts. I had to go with a classic. This is from 1978. The reason I picked it is this actress has been one of my favorites, perhaps not the most illustrious career when you think about like serious acting chops, but I also think her star is kind of on the rise in this moment, right now where we are today. The movie I'm talking about is an absolute iconic piece of filmmaking. It's up there with anything Hitchcock did. 1978's Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis.
I knew you were going to go there. As soon as you said 1978.
You knew already?
I knew.
All right. Well, listen, we've pontificated on Halloween many, many times. So what have you got at number one?
So my number one, I also want actress here. Her career is just starting to take off. We're seeing her talent in everything that she does. I don't think it's fully recognized here by everybody. And I'll get to that point further. For my number one, I went with Lupita Nyong'o, who had her debut in 12 Years a Slave, not only nominated for an Academy Award, but won the Academy Award for it. And again, a performance that didn't know this actress going into the movie, saw the film, and walked out and thought that was the best performance I had saw all year. And that really means something. When you don't know the person, you're just completely blown away by the performance, and it's powerful. It's just incredible. And you know, her other highlights, she was in Star Wars, playing Maz, Black Panther, but the performance that puts her on the map to show you how talented she is her performance in Jordan Peele's Us from last year, which the reason why I say I don't think her talents are being recognized. If you look across the critic groups around the country, ours, that were involved in, everybody was voting for Lupita for Best Actress. She was popping up at least all the time, at least nominated in the critic circles at the end of last year, and didn't get an Academy Award nomination. I don't know what they were thinking. It's still by far one of the best performances of 2019. They whiffed on that one. They completely blew it.
Big whiff. Not what I thought you were going to have at number one, Ryan.
You thought I was going to go with Hailee Steinfeld in True Grit.
I did indeed.
Honorable mention for me. My other honorables were Alan Rickman, you mentioned. Eddie Murphy, you mentioned. So I only have two left to go, and they're two heavyweights, Mackay.
Okay, lay it on me.
One of them is Orson Welles.
Oh, well,
He made his debut in Citizen Kane, which is quite incredible. And the other one, right up there with Orson Welles, has to be mentioned, is Cameron Diaz.
Oh, yeah. They're like synonymous. I think Orson Welles, and the next thing I think is Cameron Diaz.
Oh, boy.
In The Mask, right? She was in The Mask. I got a couple honorables.
But The Mask, I'm joking, but I'm really not joking in the sense of it was, you know, maybe not the best acting, but it was a star-like performance. I think if you went back and you watched The Mask, you knew that Cameron Diaz was at least going to be a movie star, not necessarily a great actress, but she was going to be somebody when you watched that movie. You could see her.
Listen, talent. I think Cameron Diaz has got some chops, believe it or not, given the right role. But I don't know if we saw that in The Mask. I'm going to have to take your word for it on that one. My honorables were Marlee Matlin from Children of a Lesser God. She debuted in that film and won the Oscar and went on to have a pretty decent career after that. Maya Taylor, who was in Tangerine, just a fantastic performance. I don't even think she's an actress prior to this, like just kind of came off the street into this. Natalie Portman in Leon the Professional.
Just I thought that would be on your list for sure.
Yeah, that was actually my number six. It just missed. I wanted to talk about Julie Andrews, Ryan. And that's it. I think we mentioned all the others.
All right, Jawheads. If we missed an actor, actress that has a screen debut that you think is worthy of being on a top five, write us feedback at cinemajaw.com or a tweet at cinemajaw. We'll get that discussion rolling. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got Hollywood headlines, and for the first time ever, Matt Kay is taking his wife on in movie trivia. Stick with us.
In honor of Michael Shannon Month, we bring you this clip from his turn as General Zod in The Man of Steel.
General Zod, for the crimes of murder and high treason, the council has sentenced you and your fellow insurgents to 300 cycles of somatic reconditioning. Do you have any last words?
You won't kill us yourself! You wouldn't sully your hands, but you'll damn us to a black hole for eternity! Jor-El was right. You're a pack of fools, every last one of you.
And you... believe your son is safe?
I will find him. I will reclaim what you have taken from us.
I will find him. I will find him, Lara.
I will find him!
We are back on CinemaJaw. Matt, before we get to trivia and before we get to some Hollywood headlines, is Heather ready? Because
yeah,
you got to cue her up.
She's all set, Ryan, ready okay. to go.
All right, before we get there, we did throw a few items into the fish tank, we call it the jaw box, to look up if we got anything wrong. You were asking about Mary Poppins and if it was 50 years old.
Yes, I was.
It is. It is 56 years old. It came out in 1964.
Wow. Jesus, man. I mean, that's a long time ago, but still holds up. It's an absolute classic.
Yep. 56 years old. Speaking of age, I threw in, how old was Jason Schwartzman when he made Rushmore? 18 years old for Jason Schwartzman.
Wow.
In that wonderful Wes Anderson movie.
My favorite bit in the whole movie is the scene in the elevator when he's wearing his OR scrubs.
He it's says, not an elevator, but...
isn't it? It's like, no, these are my OR scrubs. Oh, are they?
I love that line. That's yeah, they go out to dinner. And prior to that, he says, hey, guy, what's with the nurse's outfit? These are OR scrubs. Oh, are they?
I love that. The whole movie's fantastic. Rushmore is your Rushmore, Ryan.
It is. Those were the only two items that we threw into the fish tank. So we do got some Hollywood headlines here, Matt. And first... get a load of this. Amazon Prime to stream South by Southwest 2020 films for free. If you'll recall here, South by Southwest canceled. It was the first like major festival, major gathering that got canceled due to the coronavirus. And now Amazon is offering filmmakers of the 2020 South by Southwest Film Festival lineup an invitation to opt in to take part in this online film festival, which will play exclusively on Amazon Prime in the US for a 10-day period. What do you think of that? Online film festival.
Yes, I'm on board, man. I'm all for change. I'm all for access. I'm all for filmmakers getting accepted to a major film festival that unfortunately got canceled, still getting their moment to shine. And honestly, this might open them up to an even bigger audience than they would have gotten just at South by. So,
yeah, the interesting thing to look for here when this does take place and go online for further details is that to see what films actually do play at this online event, because some of the films are actually trying to be sold to distributors and trying to make money here. And I've seen some filmmakers that were going to be in South by say that they weren't going to go that route because they're worried about leaks, it going online, all that stuff when they're actually trying to sell it for, you know, some money to a distributor. So
I see
both sides of the coin. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out.
All right. Well, here's another one. This will elevate your mood here. The Making of Beetlejuice, Ryan, is coming. The name of the doc is Documentary for the Recently Deceased. It will dive deep into the production of the film, from shooting in the small town of East Corinth, Vermont, to crafting intricate stop-motion animated creatures and effects.
You've got to be excited for this.
I mean, yeah, you've got to be excited for this, right?
Oh, yeah. Everybody loves Beetlejuice. And you know what it actually got me thinking? Not just stop here at Beetlejuice, but you know, we got all these old movies that are they sometimes make a big deal like, hey, it's going to be on Netflix or it's going to be on Amazon Prime this month. What a great time for these films to do maybe like an hour documentary about a film and then release it on that platform when it comes out. So say in May, Beetlejuice is going to be on Netflix. And with it, here's a documentary about the making of Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice.
It's showtime.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the saddest things we did lose in the end of the DVD era was all the extras. We lost that director commentary track. We lost that making of featurette. By and large, I mean, they still exist, but we don't have such easy access. They're not tied to the same physical piece of media. To see that coming back around, I agree with you, Ryan. That'd be great to get some sort of bundle package because I miss that more than anything else.
I don't know. It would make me excited to like stream the movie again and then maybe watch a behind the scenes feature, you know, if it was done right. I'm not talking about a 20-minute feature, but give me like an hour long documentary on a particular film. And this isn't going to work for every film ever made, but those particular films that have a, you know, a following to them that people would care and be interested in seeing, I think that would be really neat.
Were you a director's commentary kind of guy? Would you rewatch a film with the commentary on?
You know what happened? I for a while there, I was working from home, you know, just by myself, and it was for numerous years. And you got to fill time when you're at home, like we are now with quarantine. But this was before a lot of Alexas and all that kind of stuff. So one of the things I actually did do was go through my DVD collection during that span while I was at home, and I would play a movie with the TV off, but with my sound system going, and listen to the director's commentary, which basically played out almost like talk radio in a way about
like a
your favorite movie. Right. And so I would just have that on. Every once in a while, they would be talking about something very specific on screen. I'd have the TV off and I'd get a gist at least of knowing what they were talking about. But I went through probably about 50 movies in my collection during that time of just listening to director's commentaries. How about you?
Yeah, if I liked a film, I'd go back and watch it a second time with a director's commentary on. Quite a few. I remember watching Braveheart with a director's commentary. Mel Gibson. Also a Mel Brooks movie with the director's commentary, Spaceballs, and a bunch of others, man. So yes, I was always a big, I think, you know, I probably wouldn't be doing a podcast like this if I wasn't a director's commentary listener at some point, you know?
Yeah, they were quite interesting. There one Wes Anderson one, I want to say it's The Life Aquatic. I'm pretty sure it's Life Aquatic, where him and Noah Baumbach, who wrote it, recorded the director's commentary at a diner where they had more or less wrote the screenplay. You know, that kind of like fun stuff that it was just like you could hear the chatter of going on around them and they would just talk about the movie and how it came to be and all that good stuff. I enjoyed the heck out of those.
Yeah, me too. Something I think we're sorely missing nowadays. So I hope they come back in full form.
Agree. All right, that's it for Hollywood headlines, Matt. So it brings us to the main event. It's time to play some trivia. Oh, I missed that music.
It's back.
I love it. It's back. The movie trivia music is back. I love it. As we mentioned, we're recording these at our respective homes. It's been tough to find an opponent, so Matt's lovely wife, Heather, agreed to take Matt K on in a Cinema Jaw first. The Kabinskis taking each other on in movie trivia. So in honor of that, we decided to do spouse movie trivia. Heather, welcome to Cinema Jaw.
Thanks a lot.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, in honor of Matt taking Heather on in movie trivia, we decided to do spouse movie trivia.
Oh, geez. Okay.
And of course, it's sort of a twisted spouse movie trivia since Matt's taking Heather on for the first time ever. Heather, yeah. It works like this. You're our guest. You get to choose if you want to go first. Let Matt K go first. There are steals. And if you get hung up on any questions, you get one rescue. Rescue me, Ryan. I have clues to all the questions. Now, they do start off easy. So do you want to go first or let Matt go first?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go first.
All right. Question one in spouse movie trivia. Heather, Harrison Ford's wife is killed by a one-armed man and then chased through the city of Chicago in this 1993 film. Name it.
I have no idea. One-armed man.
Harrison Ford's wife is killed by a one-armed man, and then he is chased by Tommy Lee
Harrison
Jones
Ford,
through
Chicago
the city
movies.
Of Chicago.
I have no idea.
Tommy Lee Jones.
This is a bad start.
Take
any
a guess?
No, I don't have a guess.
All right.
Wow, Matt, you got a chance for a steal here. I don't know. I'm writing these easy. I was hoping. Here we go, Matt.
I mentioned that I was nervous to take on Heather, and it's a triple lose. I have decided this is a lose 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 situation. So, first of all, she's incredibly competitive. One time we were playing Trivial Pursuit when we were dating, and she flipped the board over. That's not a joke. It is true, and. So if I lose, she wins because she's going to gloat. If I win, I lose because she's never going to let me forget it. And it's a lose because the two of you on are going to gang up on me.
Yeah.
And I can't win. This is a lose, lose, lose. But the answer to the first question is The Fugitive.
I must have missed that one.
1-0, Matt K. Question two is over to Matt. I did write these fairly easy so everybody would have a shot here. So Matt, question two, how about this? Tim Robbins' wife is killed and he gets blamed for it and put in prison only to escape in this 1994 movie.
You know that one, right? Shawshank Redemption.
I read the book, but...
2-0, Matt K. Question three, back over to Heather. Heather, in 1990... Demi Moore starred in Ghost, where her husband is murdered. Who played her husband who comes back as a ghost?
Oh, Patrick Swayze. Yes.
2-1. Heather is on the board. Question four over to Matt K. Matt, in 2014, Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike played a married couple. But when his wife, Amy, goes missing, he becomes a prime suspect. Name the film.
Heather actually knows this one. I could tell. Just she just completely tensed up like she's trying to keep a secret, really. That would be Gone Girl.
You should have.
Did you read that book?
Yeah, and you should have passed that one to me.
Oh,
just
I see.
So I could have.
Here comes the lose.
You knew that. You knew I had that one.
3-1, Matt. We got to get this one right, Heather. Question five is over to you. In the movie Seven, Brad Pitt's wife, her head ends up chopped off and in a box. Who played his wife in the movie Seven?
Gwyneth Paltrow? Okay.
We got a ball game here. We got a good ball game. Yeah. 3-2. 3-2. Matt's still in the lead here. And question six is over to Matt. Matt, The 1954 movie Dial M for Murder is about a husband planning to have his wife, who's played by Grace Kelly, murdered. Who directed this film?
You know this? Wow, I'm impressed. Alfred Hitchcock.
Of course I know this one.
We got a cat on the counter. Cat wants to play trivia.
4-2, question 7, back over to Heather. Heather, the movie Double Jeopardy, which sees Ashley Judd framed for murder by her husband, also starred this actor who played the parole officer, Travis Lehman, assigned to her case.
Ugh.
He was mentioned earlier in this trivia on a question you got wrong. And you do have a rescue if you need it.
Is this my last one? This is my last question?
It could be, yeah.
Go ahead and use your lifeline.
My Rescue Me Ryan?
Yeah. Whoa, Rescue Me Ryan. Question Come on, Ryan. 7.
You know you want me to win.
Yeah, the name of the actor in question here is three names. His initials are TLJ.
Oh, Tommy Lee Jones?
Wow. Wow. It is 4-3. Let me set it up here. It's 4-3. It's the last question of the game. If Matt answers this correctly, he wins. If he misses it, Heather has a chance to tie.
So I lose no matter what. Yeah. Okay.
He knows where he's sleeping if he gets this next one right.
Matt, last question of the game. Harrison Ford starred in this 1998 Roman Polanski directed film that takes place in Paris and sees his wife abducted from their hotel room. Name the film.
Holy crap, man.
It's funny looking at you guys on Skype because Heather's smiling. I think she might know it, but I can't tell. Maybe she has a great poker face. I don't know.
Okay, so my initial guess was going to be American Graffiti, but that was George Lucas, right? Not Roman Polanski. So Rescue Me, Ryan.
Whoa, Rescue Me, Ryan. Your clue to this one is one word title starts with F. And it's not the fugitive mask.
Is it fuck? la la la. Faust. I have no idea.
Heather, I don't know. This is a tough one. You got a chance for a steal and to tie the ball game. Harrison Ford, 1998 Roman Polanski film. In Paris, his wife gets abducted from their hotel room. Name the film.
I don't know it. Damn, I was just excited. I was just excited because you didn't know it.
I really thought she knew it.
Well, you could take a guess. It starts with an F and it's one word.
I think I remember, like, something, but I have no idea.
Well, take a guess. Just throw out a word that starts with F.
I don't know. Funny. I don't know. I have no idea, you guys.
We were looking for Frantic. Frantic.
Frantic.
Yeah. If it came down to a tiebreaker.
Oh, so he won?
Yeah, Matt does win this one. Matt does win this one. 4-3.
This is a rare on-camera handshake. We don't see these anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go. If it came down to a tiebreaker, we call it a jawbreaker, this question would have been over to Matt K. Matt, what year did you guys get married?
It was because we got married and then we had a wedding. 2012.
Holy cow. Wow.
Did I get it wrong?
You didn't get either one of the years right.
2010, right? Jeez
Louise.
When do we get married?
I have down here, I did my research and I was looking at Wikipedia and such, and I saw 2007. Do I have that right, Heather?
No, that's not right either.
Yes, you do, Rye.
Well, that's when we got married, but not there when we got our
wedding.
That's
what I was looking for. Well, it's nine? Far off from 2012.
Eight.
Wow.
Jeez, Matt. 2012 and then 2010.
It seems like only yesterday, Ryan.
Yeah.
The real jawbreaker was this. In honor of Parker, your oldest son, I was looking for the age of Tobey Maguire, who played Peter Parker in the first Spider-Man film. Closest to, how old is Tobey Maguire? Matt, you got to guess.
The first Spider-Man movie came out in the aughts, and he must have been in his 20s, and that was almost 20 years ago. Let's say like 15 years ago. Tobey so Maguire. I'd say he's in his late 30s, maybe early 40s. By now, let's say he's, I'll just say he's 42.
Lock him in at 42. Heather, you got a guess?
Wait, the question is how old was he in the movie or how old is he now?
Today.
Gosh, he doesn't seem that old. 36?
Give that one to Matt K. 44.
Wow.
44 for Tobey Maguire.
Wow, good for him.
Yeah. Well, Matt wins this one. It probably stirred some argument later on after we get off the call. There's going to be fisticuffs over at the Kabinski household, I take it.
I was told this was going to be trivia about Moana. That's why I came, actually.
Oh, that's – Matt. I was looking for ideas, and I text Matt through the Alexa app, and I say, hey, any ideas – for trivia. I was really looking for something to make it competitive. What should I go with that Heather's into? He writes back, she really likes Moana. What? I can't write eight trivia questions about Moana.
Yes, she did, you could.
She did just as well as I did. That was a tense ball game.
It was. 4-3 was good. 4-3 was good. Well, Heather, thanks for being a sport and coming on.
Thanks a lot for having me. Bye.
Well, that was fun, Matt. I love how you mentioned it was a lose-lose no matter what. If you won in trivia, you were losing no matter what. I feel sorry for you right now.
Yeah, I lost, guys. I mean, like I said, this was there was no way for me to win.
Yeah, I kept asking all these questions where the spouse ended up killing the other spouse in the movie.
I noticed that.
Good times, good times. Brings us to the end of a great Jaw. And first and foremost, we got to thank Heather for coming on the Jaw. Make sure you thank Heather. She ran out of there right away.
Yeah, she did. Well, she's an early riser. So early to bed, early to rise. So she had to go to bed.
We also got to thank our sponsors.
Yes, thanks to Jiffy On Demand and to Overcast for being sponsors of the show. And thanks to the Chicago Podcast Co-op for helping us get great sponsors like them.
If you would like to support Cinema Jaw, the easiest way to do so is by leaving us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast.
And please, guys, while you're there, click subscribe, one extra button, and it really helps us out a lot.
Until next week, I'm Ry the Movie Guy.
I'm Matt Kay, and keep on jawing about the movies.